This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After writing books about Karl Rove, Tom DeLay, and George W. Bush, my guest Lou DuBose has co-authored a new critical biography of Dick Cheney. The book, Vice, describes Cheney as the most powerful vice president ever to occupy the office. Before becoming vice president, Cheney served in the Nixon administration, was President Ford's chief of staff, spent 10 years in Congress, was President George H.W. Bush's Secretary of Defense, and the CEO of Halliburton. The new book ends with 25 questions for the vice president. Lou DuBose, welcome to Fresh Air. Why do you end the book with 25 questions that you'd like to ask the vice president?
In part because he would answer no questions to us, but that's not uncommon. He rarely responds to the media. The other is because I think that there are some questions that are of compelling interest to the public to know that that the vice president and his office have steadfastly refused to respond to.
Well, let me read one of the questions you ask, and this has to do with the vice president's energy task force, which he established soon after taking office as the vice president. And the question is, why was your energy task force reviewing maps of the Iraqi oil field in 2001, 2 years prior to the Iraq war, while Iraq oil was embargoed? How do you know that the energy task force was actually reviewing maps of the Iraqi oil field?
We would never know were it not for a lawsuit filed by a conservative watchdog group, Judicial Watch, who actually got copies of the maps of the oil fields. And besides the maps of the oil fields were lists of suitors, corporate suitors to carve up the who would be carving up the oil fields in Iraq. At the time, Iraq was the country was under embargo. A limited amount of oil was allowed to be sold in the Oil for Food program. Yet here was the vice president and a group of oil men secretly meeting because the public was not allowed access to the meetings nor to know the names of the lobbyists and poring over the maps of the Iraq oil fields. We thought it was a question that should be answered. It never has.
Do you know if there were maps of other oil fields in other countries? Perhaps it wasn't unusual that there was an Iraq oil field map. Maybe there were maps of Iran and Saudi Arabia and South American countries with oil.
Mostly Middle Eastern. There were other maps. There were continuous meetings with the Energy Task Force with Middle Eastern oil ministers. But the idea that the oil fields of Iraq were being divided up among corporate suitors in the office by the office of the vice presidency suggests that there were obviously either short term or long term plans for regime change that would allow access to those oil fields. And we now know that the plan was short-term.
Now, another question that you ask has to do with the possibility of negotiations with Iran back in 2003. The question is, after the initial military success in Afghanistan and Iraq in 2003, the Iranian government offered to negotiate with the U.S. regarding al-Qaeda, relations with Israel, and the Iranian nuclear energy and weapons program. Why did you kill the negotiations before they began? So this is a question you would like to ask the vice president. What are these negotiations you're referring to?
Well, this was an extraordinary moment, Terry. Following the stunning success, this was in Afghanistan, and then the success in marching through into Baghdad, the American army, the Iranians were terrified. They felt like they were next in the gun sights. This was before the Iraq war had collapsed into a failure of a protracted occupation and now a civil war. The Iranians were terrified, and they felt like their only option was to offer to negotiate with the U.S. And they, through the Swiss embassy, because we have no direct diplomatic relationships with the Iranians, they offered pretty much to put everything on the table. If you think of what's going on now, or what's gone on recently, this included support for Hezbollah. This included their nuclear program. This was before President Ahmadinejad was elected, and there were moderates in Tehran. Yet, after all this, the success of this coercive diplomacy, which is what the neocons believe in, they surrendered essentially, or at least they gave themselves over to negotiation. And Dick Cheney killed that negotiation. I think it's a valid question, and would like to know why.
How do you know that that this offer was made by the Iranian government through the Swiss, and how do you know that Vice President Cheney killed the offer?
The documents have been obtained from the Swiss. It has been made public, and Colonel Larry Wilkerson, who was Colin Powell's longtime aide, both at the Defense Department and at the State Department, revealed that Dick Cheney made the decision to kill these negotiations because he, you know, when you go back to there was an odd moment in the early history of Dick Cheney when he was a member of Congress and he was in Moscow as the ranking member. This was in the early 80s. As a ranking member of a delegation to Moscow, he was invited in to speak to a Soviet Marshal Akhremiev, who was the number three man in the Soviet Union, who offered to reopen negotiations on arms on U.S.-Soviet arms development and deployment. He was in there with Congressman Tom Downey of New York. They came out and Downey announced it, and Cheney said that it never happened, although there was a State Department witness to the offer. Dick Cheney doesn't believe in negotiating with your enemies, was what Downey said at the time, and said again recently in an interview. He thinks that negotiation from a position of power means you impose your will on them. He didn't negotiate with the Iranians. Consequently, we now have Iran starting up their enrichment program of uranium, and it's something that could have been dealt with through negotiations 3 years ago.
Well, perhaps those negotiations would have been successful. Perhaps they wouldn't. We don't know. I guess we'll never know.
Right.
Now you say that the U.S. wrote a letter of protest to the Swiss for interfering in our foreign policy after they forwarded to us this request from the Iranians to negotiate in 2003. Have you seen this actual document to the Swiss from the U.S.?
No, I haven't, but I have it from two sources, and Colin Powell will not respond to it. I think it's particularly embarrassing for him, but I have it from two sources inside the State Department that the Swiss were reprimanded for that act, and that actually has been published one time before.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Lou DeBose, and he's the co-author of a new book called Vice, which is about Vice President Dick Cheney. And the book ends with a list of 25 questions that the authors would like to ask the Vice President. Let me read another one of those questions, and this has to do with the agenda for negotiations with North Korea in 2004. And the question is, considering the North Korean missile tests in June 2006 and North Korea's development of nuclear weapons, how do you justify the constraints you personally imposed on a negotiation agenda that had been drafted and approved by the President and Secretary of State in 2004? What is this negotiation agenda, and what were the constraints that you say the Vice President put on the agenda?
At the time, it was believed it was in our national interest to negotiate with the North Koreans to try to keep the nuclear genie in a bottle. There is a process by which a negotiating agenda for a State Department diplomat is put together. That process involves a consensus of a group of people that involves the President, the Vice President, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, the Chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the Chair of the National Security Council. They would sit and draft an agenda, and it would be approved through this statutory process. On at least two occasions that we know of, the Vice President, after that draft was prepared and signed, the Vice President rewrote the talking points for the U.S. negotiator traveling to North Korea or to China. What Cheney did was he ensured that the negotiator had nothing in his pocket, that there was nothing that could be said regarding any sort of compromise that the U.S. would make, and in essence, killing the negotiation. Colonel Larry Wilkerson, who served with Colin Powell at the State Department, insists that that these guys are incapable of diplomacy, and they're incapable because Bush and Cheney in particular won't let it happen.
So do you think that this decision to limit what could be discussed in talks with North Korea in 2004 has affected where we are now with North Korea?
Well, it's hard to prove one way or another. However, what we do know is that North Korea has now detonated an atomic weapon. Up till that point, they hadn't. And, the back and forth between whether the Clinton administration, the former Clinton administration, and the Bush administration as to who's responsible is moot on that point because there were no nuclear weapons detonated until just recently.
I'm going to read another question from the list of 25 questions that you'd like to ask Vice President Cheney. And this question has to do with his position during the Gulf War on Iraq and his position in 2003 when we invaded Iraq. And the question is, how do you explain the complete reversal of your position on invading and occupying Iraq, a course of action you unequivocally opposed as George H.W. Bush's Secretary of Defense? What exactly was Dick Cheney's position when he was Secretary of Defense under the first President Bush?
I must observe that if you go to the Pentagon and talk to those generals who are willing to talk, Dick Cheney is universally admired as being one of the finest, if not the finest, modern Secretaries of Defense. He served the American military well as the Pentagon brass sees them. After the first Gulf War, he made a compelling argument immediately after the first Gulf War as why the U.S. didn't go on into Baghdad and destroy Saddam Hussein's regime. It had to do with the fact that there would be a protracted occupation. The cost of the occupation would be high in American lives. It would overextend the military. All the arguments that we now see being played out were arguments that Dick Cheney then made. It was beyond our mandate. He felt like at the time that the U.S. policy to stop short of overthrowing Hussein was a wise policy decision at that time.
And have you been able to talk to anybody who has explained to you the reasons for his change of mind about what our course of action in Iraq should be?
Yeah, it's hard to get inside, of course, anyone's head, inside the vice president's head, and we don't certainly have any access to meetings in the office of the vice presidency. There are two arguments. One was made by a defense analyst who worked for Georgia Senator Sam Nunn, who was the chair of the Senate Armed Forces Services Committee. He believes that he makes the argument that on 9/11, Dick Cheney had what he described as an intellectual stroke. He became a policy hysteric, and overreacts to every possible threat the U.S. faces. I think the more logical explanation is that Dick Cheney saw this moment after 9/11 as a time when we could consolidate all of the powers of the presidency that he saw lost when he was serving in the Richard Nixon administration as a very young man, and then in the Ford administration. He could put the powers of the executive back together, recreate the imperial presidency, and thus defend the United States. He's also a true believer. I think that the vice president genuinely believes that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction.
In your book about Vice President Cheney, you describe the vice president as very secretive, and that's a criticism that many of his critics have made of him. One of the questions you'd like to ask him pertains to that, and the question is, why doesn't the public have a right to know who serves on the vice president's staff and the size and details of the staff budget office and how many documents it has classified? What is secretive about his staff?
That's quite remarkable. Almost everything. We know from press reports who's on the staff, but we don't know who's on the staff in terms of who else is on the staff. Reporters will call the OVP, the Office of the Vice President, and they will ask if a certain person is a vice presidential staffer, and they will be told that information is not available to the public. This is the largest vice presidential staff in the history of the modern presidency, therefore the history of the presidency, of course. It is the most closed and most secretive. This is the only vice presidential staff that has set up a shadow National Security Council staff that monitors all the email traffic with the president's national security staff, while the president's staffers don't get to look back into the email of Vice President Cheney's staff. It's quite remarkable the closed nature of this vice presidency.
You would also like to ask the vice president why he doesn't release his complete medical history and the list of medications that he's taking. What do you feel you need to know that you don't already know? I mean, we know something about his heart condition, and didn't he have like a pacemaker installed since he became vice president?
Yeah, Vice President Cheney has had his first heart attack when he was running for Congress in 1978. I think that if one were applying to be CEO of a company, the board of directors and the shareholders would have a right to know the state of that applicant's health. Dick Cheney has had 4 to 5 major coronary events in his life, and I think the question bears on whether he's fit to hold the office or fit to succeed President Bush in the event of the president's death or incapacity. There are other questions. I mean, you have to ask what sort of blood thinners he's taking. Most people in his condition would take Coumadin. Here you had a man taking a blood thinner that potentiates alcohol. At a time, he admitted that he was had a beer on a bird hunt shortly before he shot someone shot his friend in the face. I mean, I think there are a lot of implications, and it just seems that reasonable that the vice president would level with the American people about the state of his health.
If his doctors felt that he was unfit, wouldn't they say something?
Perhaps. But there's a doctor-patient relationship with a client, just as there is as legal privilege for a lawyer. And I think it would be incumbent upon the patient to release that information, or to release his doctor, or to provide his doctor a release to provide the information.
You wanted to interview the vice president for your book about him. He did not grant you an interview. What were some of the difficulties you had in researching Vice President Dick Cheney when he wouldn't grant you an interview?
It's always preferable for a writer to interview the subject of a book. Not always necessary, though, obviously, and certainly not with politicians, who often are so very guarded that you get nothing from them. The difficulty was, in this case, it was in a sense like writing a book about a mafia don, and I don't say that as an insult to the vice president, but that many people in Washington fear him. There are members of Congress who would meet with us and talk with us only off the record, in part because they feared that if they got crossways with the vice president, they would get crossways with the Republican Party and lose potential lobbying prospects in the future when they leave Congress. Military officers would meet with us mostly off the record because they also feared retribution from the vice president or the vice president or the Secretary of Defense. Or because they feared that by association with a book critical of the vice president, their careers would be impaired. It's a challenge, but it's not insurmountable.
You have a previous book you co-wrote about Tom DeLay. Now that Tom DeLay has resigned, and as a result of the indictment against him on charges of campaign finance violations, and now that he remains on the ballot in Texas, but so there'll be a write-in candidate. The party legally wasn't allowed to take Tom DeLay off the ballot. How do you think Congress has changed without him?
I think that the Congress has changed substantially without him. Tom DeLay, he was a majority leader, unlike any who had come before him, and it was he who was able to keep the Republican majority in line and working on behalf of the vice presidency and the president, the vice president and the president. I think the recent Mark Foley scandal would have been much better handled if Tom DeLay were in power. I think that the fragmentation of the leadership that you now see with Speaker Denny Hastert fighting with Majority Leader John Boehner would not have happened if Tom DeLay were in power. His absence has left the Congress, I think, badly impaired. It has imperiled the Bush-Cheney agenda, and I think that's part of the reason that they're fighting so very hard, and Cheney's is raising so much money in order to preserve a Republican majority because Denny Hastert now becomes essential to them. And Bush is very obviously dedicated to keeping Hastert in office.
Well, Lou DeBose, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Lou DeBose is the co-author of the new book Vice about Dick Cheney. His new book about Tom DeLay is called The Hammer Comes Down.